the hospitality of the Holt and the Boyds, but also for the work that so many did in preparation. We got here fairly early Friday afternoon, and Tracy was already here doing stuff, trying to figure out about the sound and the video and the chairs and how we should arrange things. And I know behind that, there were many others who were preparing, having made copies of material and so on. And that's the way a working church works together. And that's the way things are accomplished. Russ implied that this material that we presented was really originally prepared for private use within our own church to try to train men who would someday, shortly we hope, become elders. It was never our intent to make a roadshow out of this, and Russ and I are not preachers, fully supported in any way. Maybe you'll know that even more fully at the end of this lesson. But the point is that the elders here, through their desire to not only train men, but I believe to be better themselves, put themselves up to the scrutiny of God's Word, have invited us, however unqualified we feel, and really actually somewhat intimidated because the men serving here have been serving for such a long time, and obviously the fruits of their labor are all around, and we can see it even in this weekend. But they put us to work, and that's a good thing. I would just say by way of personal introduction that I am Patsy Breeding's son. That may mean something to people who have gray hair or that are out in the audience. But the old home place is a mile or two down the road where my granddad had his farm. And as a child, that area meant a lot to me. And I can remember coming to Eastside and playing with with Sam Binkley's kids in the backyard across the way, and actually playing ping pong with Cherry Hall on occasion as well. So there's a kind of a history of my visiting this church having meant a lot. And I would add that Sam Binkley, in many ways, was a mentor to my dad, and by means of inheritance, I've inherited his influence through the years as a result of the difference he made in my own dad's life when he was in his 20s and needed to be set on a useful path in the kingdom. I want to make the lesson a little shorter. I'm not telling you it's going to be short, but I'm saying it'll be a little shorter if I say two things first. The first one is that we have had a whole weekend covering kind of the same topic on eldering and that kind of thing. I'm going to say some of the same things. You know what? If you weren't here, you won't know the difference. And if you were here, I just want you to know I'm not quite to the point where I just repeat the same things over and over again and I don't know it. That may happen actually still sometimes, but if I say the same thing, I will resist and I will fail. But I will resist saying as we said or as Russ said or whatever. Truth is, most of whatever I have to say either came from Russ or was filtered through his wisdom anyway, and I have enjoyed serving with him as an elder and now sitting at his feet as a flock, part of the flock in Ember Hill. So I'm not going to say that. Okay? Second comment, which I want to make at the very beginning, and it covers all that I'll have to say, and that is, the Bible shows a picture of shepherds, godly shepherds. God is a shepherd. Jesus is a shepherd. Shepherds in the New Testament. And those images come from other images, which are equally challenging, the fathers as they should be. We'll talk about that. That is the topic this morning. I'm not any of those things. And I so fall so far short. And it is another humbling experience to stand and say, this is what shepherds should be, and I'm aware of what I am. And I have a son here to help testify to that if there's any doubt about it. So just let me say this at the start, and so I don't have to keep saying it over and over. I am not these things. I ought to be, and I count on God's grace to forgive me as I keep trying and asking for forgiveness. Be better and closer to his pattern of what he wants us to be. So that maybe shortens the lesson with those two comments. We'll be reviewing, but you won't know it. And second is that I am not those things. It was about, I guess it's been 12 years ago now, that there was a special service, and Sewell Hall and Paul Griffin and Ken Johnston came to the front of the auditorium, and they called me up. And it was that time that I was to be appointed as an elder. And there are various ways to do that appointment. They called me up and they had some things to say. I felt very undeserving, still do. But at the end of that service, and this is a tradition at Embry Hill, and that is that if a man's appointed to work, an elder, deacon, at the end of the service, before everyone's dismissed, the man will go to the back of the auditorium. And so as the members pass out, I don't mean faint. I mean, but as they leave the auditorium, they will greet the man and shake his hand one by one, individually, you know, showing support for that man. But that leaves an awkward moment because you come up and someone shakes your hand and they say, what do they say? Well, They kind of say usually congratulations. Well, there's something not quite right about that. Maybe they say condolences. Maybe that's more correct. What is it that they say? You are very deserving of this or something. And the reason it's hard to know what to say in our kind of casual conversation is we don't really have a good model for what it is to have a man appointed to be an elder in the rest of our lives. Our models are something like this. You've won an election. You beat all the other candidates. You got more votes than anyone else. And so maybe congratulations are in order. You've been given some amount of authority or something like that. Is that what's happened? It's really not quite that, is it? It could be that you've been such a faithful Christian. We've given you some tests and you passed in your knowledge of the Word. And we've run you by these characteristics. And you've been so faithful to be on time to every service. And you've been so helpful to so many Christians. We're just going to give you an award for lifetime achievement. That's what you've gotten. You're now anointed to be an elder. You can wear the pin, perhaps. I'm given that award. So, congratulations on the award. Is that what's happened? Well, it could be that we think of a corporation. And you know, you start out as a worker, maybe on the assembly line, and you're promoted to be a supervisor, and later a division head of some kind, a foreman. And later, maybe a general manager. Maybe you actually make it to CEO. You've been promoted through the ranks from the lowly worker to the top dog in the corner office. Is that what's happened? You came as a college student. You did pretty well teaching the classes. You had some kids. We made you a deacon. You kept going. Didn't make any bad mistakes. We made you an elder. Maybe you could keep going. We'll make you the preacher someday. And you'll reach the top. Is that what's happened? Has a man been promoted through the ranks of the office? But those are the pictures we have, aren't they, in our other life, if you want to call it that, of how men are anointed or appointed or elected or something. And so what do you say to a newly appointed elder? And I think that we have to understand maybe what the church is, first of all, and second, what our discipleship, our walk as a disciple, as a Christian is, to fully understand what the role of an elder is and what should be said. This is an outline I will follow. I will talk in pictures this morning, and I don't apologize for that. I know of a great teacher who talked in pictures. He talked about chickens and hens and mustard seeds and pearl merchants and fish in the net. You know who I'm talking about. And those pictures help us understand what God's will is for us and what we should be. And I'll talk about wrong pictures, but I'll talk about Bible pictures as well. And then I want to talk specifically about pictures of the elder's work. And these are images, metaphors, similes, whatever the proper grammar term is, but they help us understand the man's work. And then how do sheep respond? What will be our response to those roles that are pictured in the Bible? I think there's some misconceptions. These are bad pictures of discipleship. And I want to talk about each of these. And see if there are not ways in which each of us may adopt these wrong pictures of our discipleship in our lives. The first is that of a train. You ever ridden a train? It used to be the way everybody traveled. You go on to the right train, you check the sign, make sure you're on the right track, you get on the train, you sit down, and you ride. And it goes. And as long as some conductor, strange guy, doesn't get out and change the sign on the front of the train and turn off and go to Chattanooga instead of to Nashville, you're all right. You get to the right place, but the effort required is minimal. And I'll tell you what else. If that train starts to give you a bumpy ride and it's not pleasant and you're having to do, perhaps get out and push the train, you'll go get on another train. Hopefully one going to the same place, but you just change trains because that's our walk and our ride as a Christian. Do we ever think of our Christian life this way? I got on the right train. Go out outside and look at the sign. You'll know I'm on the right train and I'm riding. And don't make my ride bumpy because I'm going to the right place. Is that the way we think of our Christian walk? I think sometimes we picture it as a pie. By the way, I don't guess there were trains and there may not even have been pies in the New Testament time, but there were probably similar things. But a pie piece, especially in our modern accounting time, is that there are segments of our life that are dedicated to reasonable and good, worthwhile things. I have a segment of the pie of my life that's dedicated to work, and one to my family, and one to my hobbies, and one to working out and staying healthy, And there's one that's dedicated to my work in the church, or my attendance at least, my life as a Christian. And the importance of the pie is not to get these pieces of the pie out of balance. Otherwise, you're a fanatic. You're a fanatic worker, you're a fanatic religious person, whatever, but you keep those pieces in balance with each other. Not only that, let's don't have them leaking over into one another. Have something that's happening at work influencing what would happen at church or vice versa. What I do in my Christian walk doesn't need to influence any of those other pieces of the pie. Let's keep everything in its proper place and proper balance. Do we ever think about our work as a Christian, our walk as a Christian, in terms of a segregated pie that's kept in balance, kept in check, and not allowed to leak over into any other areas of our life? And finally, I think often we think of our walk as a Christian as a checklist. Here are a minimum set of things that I have to do, and as long as I check those off, I first of all need to be baptized. And then I need to be at the building on at least Sunday, because the minimum requirement is that Lord's Supper thing that we just did. Right? And I don't have an anti-checklist too, these are things you don't do. Don't do these terrible sins. Make sure you don't get any marks on that side. But as long as I check off all the things on this side, then I am good to go. Do we ever think of our walk that way? And you know, the symptoms of these kinds of pictures of our walk as a Christian are people who would maybe only come on a Sunday morning. They wouldn't want these extra services to spill over and interrupt some of the other things, those other pie pieces in their lives. And when things get bumpy, or things are somewhat unpleasant, or there's trouble, or there's sin in the church, or whatever, we just get on another train and ride that train instead. Do we sometimes feel ourselves taking these models of our walk as a Christian, and that's the way we organize things? And I will tell you, if this is your view of the walk as a Christian, your model of a shepherd will be wrong as well, won't it? You want a conductor who doesn't mess around. He drives you where you're supposed to go and keeps the ride smooth. And you want somebody that manages that pie and helps me check my checklist off in an efficient way. There are mistaken pictures of the church, I'm resisting saying, we talked about that. That is, that the church is somehow a inspection station or a corporate business or something like that as a group. What we saw, is that in Acts 20, where Paul gives himself as an example to those shepherds, he says, I showed you in every way by laboring like this, that you should help the weak. We decided that really that passage and the one in Ephesians 4 are really a better picture of a hospital. Or a hospital is a better picture of those passages. Not perfect. Some things wrong about that model, but it's where weak people go. It's where children who at first are tossed to and fro with every wind of doctrine go, but then they become full-grown men to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, because they're bound up in that unity that's built on love and that which every joint supplies. That's the picture of the corporate church. And our picture of a walk as a Christian is not this, but what is it? What is it? What are better pictures of our walk as a Christian? Can you think of maybe Bible pictures that describe what a disciple's life is like? Well, the one picture of a walk that comes to my mind is really actually not a walk at all. It's actually a run. It's a race. It's an endurance race. Here in Hebrews 12, following that chapter, which is sometimes called the Hall of Faith or something, a list of all those heroes of faith, and it says we're looking to Jesus, he says, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. He's the runner, the master runner who's out in front. We know how he ran. We're trying to run just like he did, going to the same place. Who, for the joy set before him, endured the cross, despised the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. This passage in 1 Corinthians 9, if you know the book of 1 Corinthians, the context of that, in chapter 8, it appears that Paul is answering a question related to a matter of judgment, which has to do with the eating of meat sacrificed to idols. You know that context? And it's in that context of something that's really not necessarily wrong or right, always sinful, always right. He's saying there's judgments to be applied here, but here are some things you should think about when you decide whether to do this thing, which kind of is not a sin in and of itself, but you might decide not to do it for good reason. Here are some of the reasons, he said. Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to attain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Therefore I run thus, not with uncertainty, and I fight, not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should be disqualified. Did you watch many of the Olympics, the Winter Olympics back first of the year? And you know, they highlight these athletes. They'll go, and I think it's to help you kind of be more entertained when they actually compete, because you know their background story. You've seen where they grow up, you've seen their family, and so on. But you learn about these athletes and the kind of dedication they have put into their running. Now, it's Winter Olympics, so they don't have the run. But, you know, those athletic events. Here he mentions a fight. I think that's probably also a kind of athletic competition. Here's my question to you. Think about those Olympic athletes. Does the fact that they're competing for that gold medal, silver medal, does that influence where they choose to live? Yeah. They usually go interview the Winter Olympics in Colorado. Why Colorado? Low real estate prices? No. That's the place they can train. That's the place they can progress the furthest. You think it might influence what they eat? No, that's private business. That's their own personal business. Yes, of course, their diet is highly controlled. They might even hire doctors and nutritionists to help them eat just the right thing. We hope not take the right drug, but, you know, train their body. Would it influence whom they chose as friends? As Olympic athletes? Might it even influence who they marry? Why? Because it's important. It's a lifetime thing for them. That training is something that it leaks out of the pie piece into every part of their life because it's an endeavor. It's a long-range endurance thing. Notice the phrase here, verse 25. Those who compete are temperate what? In all things. That self-control, that discipline pervades every decision in their life. Their relationships, their diet, their activities, their use of time, the amount of sleep they get, all of that is governed by that. They even see working at some other job, think about this, as a distraction, don't they? Ideally, you don't even have to work if you're an Olympic athlete. You find a sponsor. And if you have to work, you want to find a boss that'll let you work at night so you can train all day, right? That's the way that works. Is this a better characterization of our walk as a Christian, that it affects our friends, our use of time, our choice of jobs, the place we live? This is a huge struggle. That's the thing about a fight or a run. You're struggling. You're pushing yourself every day to be better, trying to win the prize. Run is ones who win the prize. And by the way, these athletes, they're competing for a temporal crown, not an eternal crown. So ours should be even more important. Paul uses this language in 2 Timothy 2. Several times he mentions this kind of athletic thing to Timothy. But he says, if anyone competes in athletics, he's not crowned unless he competes according to the rules. But backing up a couple of verses, he mentions another imagery, which I think is important. You therefore must endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who enlisted him as a soldier. You know, the thing about warfare is it's a dangerous game. You don't do that expecting that there will be no risk in that endeavor. You're a soldier, you're under attack. And it's not a time to be distracted with the affairs of this life, to use his analogy there. We are constantly being attacked by the wiles of Satan. Think of him as a roaring lion, if we want to bring in some other pictures. There's a constant threat to us. There is not time to stop and say, hold the battle for a minute. I have to take care of some important family business. It's a 24-hour endeavor. And even those periods of rest are only there so that we can be on the watch and on the offensive in the following day. You see, these pictures are not at all like a train ride, are they? They're extra effort. They pervade throughout our lives and what we do, and they affect all of our decisions. And really, if we can make some choices beyond the minimum checklist, we'll do that because we're striving for a prize. We want to be the best at what we do. That's a picture of our Christian life. And so, by the way, both of these are used by Paul at the end of his life. He says, I've fought the good fight, I've finished the race. Both of those characterize the end of his life to say, looking back, this is what it's been about. It's been a fight, and it's been a race. So rather than these pictures of the train, the pie, and the checklist, I think a race and warfare are better. Now, that brings us to thinking about shepherds, pastors, elders, bishops. And I want you to know that, I'm skipping that phrase, there are two kinds of shepherding that we've been talking about two kinds of shepherding this week. Okay, this is a review. One is collective decisions. That is over the whole flock. And those are decisions made that just, they affect the corporate body. And that's a scriptural term. Oversee the flock of God which is among you. The flock is a singular noun there, but though it's collective. Now, with Ephesians 4 teaches us that that environment that we're creating as elders over a corporate body is a cocoon, an incubator for the progress that can be made as individuals, the sheep, each individual sheep. And the theme of what we've been trying to say this weekend is that's the work of the shepherd. When we picture shepherds, we often picture Wayne up here as we started Friday making an announcement, and that's the work of the shepherd. Call the group to order. No, that's not. The highlight, the basic effort, the theme of a shepherd is sheep shepherding. That was our theme from the beginning. What we mean by that is it's the work with each individual sheep, and I'm going to show you that as we go through. Our theme has been that although it looks corporate and there are corporate decisions to be made, and that's a good piece of work, it's hard to do, experience is helpful, it's all about sheep. Because they watch in behalf of your soul. Souls are not corporate. It's individual. That's what it's about. So if this is our walk, a race and a warfare, my question would be, if you were in a race, or going to be training for that, or in a warfare, who would not want qualified and trusted instructors, coaches, trainers, and war platoon leaders, physicians, consultants, protectors, mentors, models, cheerleaders, and I don't mean the ones that are dressed immodestly down on the sideline. I mean the ones in the stands that are shouting your name and, you know, crying and holding their breath and pulling for you in every way. Would you not want people like that to support you in your warfare and in your endurance race, your striving for the Olympic medal? Wouldn't you? Wouldn't you want that? My question would be, who would not want that? So let's look at some of the Bible pictures of the elder's work. The qualifications call for a man who has demonstrated that he rules his own house well, suggesting that that's a model for how he will take care of the church of God. And I'd like to look at several places in the New Testament where the concept of a father or mother, caretaker, caregiver, is presented as a way of describing a relationship between Christians, and mostly the Apostle Paul. In Hebrews 12, the Hebrew writer says that earthly fathers chasten for your profit. Now that's painful. It's hard to do. It requires a strategic vision. The goal is to make everyone holy, according to Hebrews chapter 12. But it requires you to manage the house in a way that each individual is disciplined in the way that's required. We were talking a little bit last night about the percent of attendance on Sunday nights and Wednesday nights. You know what I'm talking about? So here's the Sunday morning, and then Sunday night, let's say 80% will be back, and Wednesday night maybe 80%. Apparently it's very good here. And it's pretty good at Embry Hills. I don't think it's as good as it is here. Can you imagine a father managing his household by those statistics? Right? It's supper time, and there's five kids, and he said, this is great. 80% of the kids are here tonight. Now that 16-year-old girl, I don't know where she is, but 80%, you know, some families only get to 60%, in their evening meal. That's not the way father manages. He's worried about each individual child in the family. And the discipline comes on an individual basis. Paul says to the Corinthians, imitate me as a father. If you want to see what a person is, you can kind of look at their father. I think I look a lot like Patsy Breedy, by the way, if you ever knew what she looked like. But that's because she's my mother. I'm related to her in this way. Paul says, look like me, because I am your father. In the Corinthian letter, he's saying some pretty hard things to them. You know that First Corinthian letter, the first part is a lot of criticisms and warnings and things like that. But he says, you know, you may have many instructors. I think he says 10,000 instructors. Right? But you don't really have many fathers in Christ. That's a special relationship. He says, I've begotten you through the gospel. And so so imitate me. He says, as my beloved children, I warn you. This is a relationship that a father has to a child that's special. He doesn't maybe warn other children in other families, but his own child will be warned even when it's difficult. Paul was a father, and actually he says a mother, to the church in Thessalonica. Let's read this together. 1 Thessalonians 2, verse 7. We were gentle among you, just as a nursing mother cherishes her own children, affectionately longing for you. We were well pleased to impart to you not only the gospel of God, but also our own lives, because you have become dear to us. For you remember, brethren, our labor and toil, laboring night and day that we might not be a burden to any of you. We preached to you the gospel of God. Can you picture the mom who has to stay up late with the child and not resenting that? It's out of love. It's for the good of the child. Who through the pain of childbirth and the discomfort of the earliest years, takes care of the child out of love, nourishes and cherishes that child. Paul goes on to say in verse 10, you're witnesses in God also how devoutly and justly and blamelessly we behaved ourselves among you who believe. As you know, we exhorted, we comforted, we charged every one of you as a father. Think of a father, the best father you can think of, doing these things as a father does his own children, that you would have a walk worthy of God who calls you into his own kingdom. He's coaching them in their walk, which we now know is a run, or it's a warfare. But this is what fathers do in the sheep-shepherding relationship as a father. And the question would be, who would not want a caregiver like this? Doesn't this sound like a wonderful thing? Who would not want a caregiver like this? Paul said to Timothy, he calls him my true son in the faith, the beginning of that first letter. To Timothy, my true son in the faith. Think about the relationship that Paul had to that young man, Timothy. Don't know for sure if Timothy saw Paul on that first journey when he came through Lystra. We just don't know. We remember what happened to Paul is that he was beaten. So that may have made an impression on Timothy. Whether he saw it or not, he learned about it from Lois and Eunice, for sure. But when Paul came through in the second journey, imagine that. Timothy was probably not even 20 years old. College age, maybe. Think of that. Young man. And Paul said, would you go with me? And I'm not sure where we're going to go. Actually, I think I might like to go to Ephesus, but there might be a man from Macedonia in a vision that will tell me to go somewhere else. He probably didn't say that, but he didn't know where he was going to go. He would be directed as he went. Not only that, but you know, we don't know for sure how long we'll be gone. In fact, we don't even know for sure we'll make it back. It's very likely that we'll have some pretty bad things happen to us along the way, as far as persecution. Hardship, shipwreck, these were typical. And he said to Timothy, will you do that? He challenged him. And he got to Athens and he said, Timothy, you need to go back to Corinth without me, by the way. I mean to Thessalonica without me and check on those brethren. You think he challenged Timothy to do some things that felt way beyond Timothy's ability? They would have felt beyond mine as a young man, pushing him to do that. And he left him in Corinth, in the church at Corinth, to teach them his ways as he taught in every church, he said. And he warned those Corinthians. He said, now, see that he be with you without fear, he told them in the last part of that 1 Corinthians letter. He was protecting Timothy, endorsing him. In the letter to the Philippians, he told the Philippians, he says, I don't have anybody that has the same mind as Timothy. All of them are caring about themselves, but he doesn't. He cares for others. You remember those passages where Paul is coaching, challenging, endorsing, protecting Timothy. And he writes to him and he says, and I'm remembering your tears. And don't have a spirit of fearfulness. Who wouldn't want a spiritual father like that? Who would not want a spiritual father like that? The best image of shepherds in the Bible, this is going to be a big surprise, is shepherds. And shepherds are really a part of the Bible story, really beginning at the beginning. In Genesis, you remember the second generation, Abel was a shepherd, keeper of sheep. And later in time, you know, Jacob was like the master shepherd. I don't know how he did it, but he could make them come out spotted and striped or not. And the children of Jacob, children of Israel, were shepherds. And that's how they ended up in the land of Goshen, because they kept cattle and sheep, and they were given that land by Pharaoh as a result of Joseph's influence. And you come down to the shepherd king David, who killed the lion and the bear with his own hands to protect the sheep. Remember that. And he wrote that psalm that probably everybody in the world knows, Psalm 23, about the shepherd who leads me beside the still water, keeps me calm when I'm afraid, brings me food, who anoints my head with oil, restores my soul, gives me healing. All those things, the picture of a shepherd that came from David. And the great Messiah to come. Isaiah 40 was pictured as a shepherd who carried the lambs in his arms. Ezekiel 34, which we'll look at more in just a minute, is this picture of the terrible shepherds that God was throwing out and in their place putting a shepherd who would do the right things, and we'll look at that more in detail. So those are pictures of the shepherd, and we come to the New Testament, and the word, not surprisingly, is used to describe the leader of God's local church, the shepherd. And then at the book of Revelation, at the end, the great lamb who was slain, chapter 7, the lamb becomes the shepherd who leads his people by living water. So this picture of a shepherd is pervasive throughout the Bible, and it's no surprise that these images are used as well. Look at Ezekiel 34. I'd like to look at four things that the shepherd did there and apply them a little bit to our walk, our life as Christians. Ezekiel 34, verse 11. Thus says the Lord, I myself will search for my sheep and seek them out. As a shepherd seeks out his flock on the day he is among his scattered sheep, so I will seek out my sheep and deliver them from all the places where they were scattered on a cloudy and dark day. Have you ever had a cloudy and dark day? It's not quite like the Pulp Fiction dark and stormy night. There's something about days that should not be dark. But when they are, when a day that's supposed to be bright is not dark, and it may be a result of the things that happen in our lives that we don't control, but it may be the result of our own sin, that we have had a cloudy and dark day, and we need someone to come find us. Because we are lost, and we don't know how to get back. And that's what God's shepherd would do. Contrasted to verse 6, where they're scattered. And now on to verse 13. I will bring them out from the peoples and gather them from the countries. I will bring them to their own land. I will feed them on the mountains of Israel and the valleys and all the inhabited places of the country. And then over to verse 28. They shall be no longer prey for the nations, nor shall beasts of the land devour them. They shall dwell safely, no one shall make them afraid. Not just come and find them on a cloudy and dark day, but bring them to a place of safety and security and protect them from those who might attack or harm them in some way. On to verse 14. I will feed them in good pasture, and their fold shall be on the high mountains of Israel. You know, a fold is the place where sheep are enclosed and protected. There they shall lie down in a good fold and feed in rich pasture on the mountains of Israel. I will feed my flock. I will make them lie down, says the Lord God. And that's, by the way, in contrast to earlier in the chapter where the shepherds not only were not feeding the flock, they were trampling out the food, perhaps even by their own corruption, their own example, making the food worthless that might have come from God. In verse 16, I will seek that which was lost, bring it back, bring back what was driven away, bind up the broken and strengthen that which was sick. There are broken things that happen when we get lost on those cloudy and dark days. And the damage is often permanent, but it can be anointed with oil. It can be bound up. It can be made better. And that's what God's shepherds do. And who wouldn't want shepherds like this? Who would not want shepherds like this? So how does the sheep respond? One other image. I'm sorry, I want to talk about it, and that is, I think one of the things that makes us nervous about elders or elderships is this, maybe it's American, but maybe it's just human, resistance to having someone ruling over me because I sacrifice some of my own decision-making autonomy. Do you think that's an anxiety that we have? Sometimes churches are reluctant to appoint a small group of men to be elders because the larger group of men will lose some of their authority somehow. Or the people in the group who've had influence, they might not now have that same authority. But I don't want a ruler. And there are even those who would say it's not really a position of rule or authority. But it is. It's a ruler. But interestingly enough, the rule is one of work. Here are four passages that refer to elders of a church as rulers or ruling or having the flock in submission. But notice the phrases that go along with that, shown here in yellow. Let the elders who rule well be counted worthy of double honor, especially those who, what? Labor in the word and doctrine. Hebrews 13. Remember those who rule over you, who have spoken the word of God to you, whose faith follow, considering the outcome of their conduct. They've spoken the word. They're engaged in activity. 1 Thessalonians 5. Acknowledge those who labor among you and are over you, there's the rule, in the Lord, and admonish you. Esteem them highly for their work's sake. And be at peace among yourselves. In Hebrews 13, verse 17, obey those who rule over you and be submissive, for they watch out for your souls. This is work to be done. The question would be, if it's really about working and serving, who wouldn't want rulers like that? I will note that we skipped over Mark 10 Friday night. But Mark 10 concludes this. Jesus says this, whoever desires to be great among you shall be your servant. And whoever desires to be first shall be slave of all. That's the model of rulers, of leaders, of preeminent ones in the kingdom. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life a ransom for all. That's the model of the Good Shepherd. Is a servant, a slave who is in the position of a ruler. That's not the way the Gentiles do it, but Jesus said that's the way it should be. And who wouldn't want a ruler like that, whose role is work, not sitting up on high and telling others what work to do, but is working as the way in which their rule is executed. So how does sheep respond? You'll notice in each of these same four passages that there are instructions given to sheep. Double honor, follow their faith, be submissive, and esteem them highly. I want to look at particularly four verses and talk about each one. In 1 Thessalonians 5, it says, esteem them highly for their work's sake. It isn't because they're the smartest Christian. It isn't because they're perfect. It isn't because they never make mistakes. It's because they have been given a work by the Holy Spirit. And, you know, 1 Timothy 5 indicates that there's special protections that ought to be offered for elders. They should be free from criticism, especially that's unjustified. And it's interesting, in Jude, I don't remember the verse, but I remember it's chapter 1 of Jude, that there are three sins. There's Cain, and there's Balaam, and there's Korah. They're listed all in one verse, right there together. And you think about that. Cain killed his brother. Is that pretty bad? Seems like the worst of the three to me. Balaam, what did he do? He seduced the children of Israel to worship idols and commit fornication in the process of that. Remember that story? Numbers? And Korah. Korah kill anybody? Did he cause them to worship idols or commit fornication? Did Korah do that? Which of those three was punished instantly, most severely, of those three? Cain, was he? Not clear to me what his punishment. He thought it was terrible, but it wasn't that terrible in some ways. Balaam was not killed until later as part of the judgment on the Amalekites. Is that right? The Moabites, I guess. And then, but what about Korah? Instantly swallowed. What did he do? He murmured. He challenged the leadership of Moses that God had set up. I think it's a serious thing. Esteem them highly, not because they're the smartest tool in the shed, or know all the answers, or never make mistakes, but because the work they have to do is so significant. And the last thing they need, same as Moses, is someone who's critiquing and criticizing, and nagging over things that are not part of their work. And similarly, be at peace among yourselves. I think that's reflected really in the murmuring that shouldn't be there, but also in creating distractions over the things that the elders are supposed to do. Interesting passage in Acts 6 suggests that those apostles there selected men to serve so they could give their attention to the word and to prayer. Especially verse 4 mentions those two things. There are things that are important. In fact, a lot of corporate flock issues, flock shepherding issues that can be taken on by people that will free these shepherds to do the work they have to do, just like those apostles were freed from serving tables. Not that that was sinful. It was just not their priority. It was not the key thing that they were supposed to be doing. And finally, do not create grief. I want to talk just a minute about that. You remember that's the passage in Hebrews 13 that says that they may do it with joy and not with grief, or that would be unprofitable for you. What does he mean by that? How could someone or a group of people in a church cause grief to an elder? I can think of three ways, and they might all three apply, but The first is that you just murmur, complain, always causing trouble, finding ways of, you know, making the elders look bad. That would be grief for sure. Surely a distraction. Number two might be that you're bringing, I don't really think that's it. The second would be that you're bringing terrible problems, things that Christians should never bring to the elders. Don't bring adultery. Don't bring homosexuality to the elders. Don't bring alcoholism. Don't bring drug addiction to the elders. That would be a grief for them to bring those kinds of things to them. I don't think that's it. I think that's the very thing that they're there for. And I'll tell you, there's no greater joy than to see those kinds of sins, which are going to have consequences and cause great harm, but to see them healed. To believe that the grace of God can change lives, even the lives of Christians. And I think as elders, you finally learn that, you know what, Christians do these things. And our initial reaction, perhaps, as younger people is, if somebody does that, I don't even think they're a Christian. I'm sorry, I don't believe that anymore. And I think I can show you in the New Testament there were Christians who changed from that behavior, or who fell into that behavior and were able to be restored. Yes, that's grief, but it's not the grief I think he's talking about. I'll tell you what the grief is. Is when you go to someone and say, here's what you need to do. This is what God wants you to do, and it's right here. And they don't do it. And they say, I'm not going to do it. Now that's grief, because that's the very thing you're there for. And it's defeating the purpose of what a shepherd would be. And in the context of this passage, this idea of submission is that you are to submit to their guidance, their shepherding, and don't create grief, I think, by ignoring their guidance. And finally, submission. Now I have a question in a way, and that is, what does submission look like? We have something that happens a lot at Embry Hills. Right before we do the collection, which as you know is separate and apart. But right before the collection, often some of the men who do it say, the elders have set aside this time for the collection. You've heard that before? Serving as an elder, I don't actually remember setting aside that time to do the collection. I suspect the elders long in the past maybe set it aside. But is that what it means to submit to the elders? They said we're going to start at 9, so I'm there at 9. And for extra measure, I actually came to the strange weekend service because they said we're having a service. Or we had an extra activity, a work day, a gospel meeting, and I did what they said. Or they asked me to control the kids, and we've done better at that. Is that submitting to the elders? Is that really what it is? I'm going to suggest some things that might reflect the submission that I just was beginning to talk about in this previous section. Two women are not getting along, and they need to be warned about the danger of strife and gossip. What would submission look like in that situation? Two men have a long past incident that's keeping them at odds from one another. They need help to be reconciled. What would submission look like in that circumstance? The high school kids need someone to be frank with them about chaste behavior and the dangers of sexual sin. What would submission look like? Submission in that situation. A husband and wife need to be counseled to make major changes in their treatment of each other. What would submission look like? A wife needs to be persuaded to forgive an adulterous husband following the golden rule of Jesus' teaching about forgiveness. Not exploit his sin to discredit him before others. What would submission look like? A man needs to quit his job because of bad influences and neglect of his family. A single mom needs to be counseled to begin attending the Bible studies for her son's sake, not to mention her own. What would submission look like? A family needs to cut back on Little League, ballet, karate, hockey, piano lessons, Boy Scouts, because it's setting the wrong priorities in the minds of their children. They're missing opportunities to grow spiritually. A talented college student needs to be pushed to be a teacher, to be more active in the church, and make commitments and keep them. A man feels shunned and angry because he isn't asked to lead singing enough or make talks. What would submission look like in that situation? A family is spending itself into debt. It's taking control of it. What would submission look like in that circumstance? And, you know, that's a case where something's happening, and if the elders are good enough and diligent enough and watchful enough and aware enough, they'll address it. My question is, what would submission look like? But I wonder if it's possible that before these problems arise, that the flock, the sheep, I should say, come to the shepherd and say, help me with this. I need a coach. I need a leader. I need a doctor. A father brings his son to the elders to talk to them about the dangers of his teenage years, and maybe about obedience to the gospel. A young man has questions about whether he's ready for marriage and maybe about whether he's making the right choice for whom to marry. And he comes to the elders. A parent comes to the elder to ask advice on handling dishonesty that's beginning to be seen in his young son. A young man is asking advice on what kind of job or career to follow so that he can grow in a spiritual way in his life. A young girl wants help answering her friends at school who are making challenges to her faith. She comes to the elder for advice. A young preacher asks for honest feedback, not good lesson at the end of the service, on his sermon and his approach to studying the Bible. What would submission, that's what submission looks like. Taking advantage of these coaches and cheerleaders. And my question is, who would not want shepherds like them? And I think you can see now the answer to this question. Who doesn't want shepherds like this are anyone who sees their Christian walk as a train ride, or pieces of a pie, or a checklist where I could just do the minimum. That's who will not want a shepherd like this. But those who see their walk as a race, a battle for survival, that's what they'll need. And they'll depend on it, and they'll use it. And that's the way the sheep respond in the sheep shepherding role. So I think maybe we figured the answer to this one out. What do you say to a newly appointed elder? We could go back to the back of the auditorium and the members are filing out. What would you say? What's the right thing to say in God's plan? I think it's this. I'm following. And if you don't think that will strike fear into the heart of a newly appointed boy trying to do a man's job shepherd, there isn't anything that can be more intimidating than that, but also more challenging. I'm following. And that leads me to say this, really. And that is that we've already said the Messiah was pictured as a shepherd, and that one of the last pictures we see of Jesus is the slain lamb becoming the shepherd of the sheep. This idea of submitting in this way is bigger than just submitting to an elder, to a shepherd of a local flock. There's a chief shepherd behind all this. And what's happening is a challenge in our lives. Are we willing to submit to the chief shepherd? That may be the real question that's behind this. I am following. And if we're resistant to take advice from those who are there for our help, for our purpose of helping us grow, to protect us, how willing are we to submit to the Lamb of God, slain for our sins, who's calling, begging us to come into the fold of safety, where there's rest? That's really the question. Is who will follow Jesus, isn't it? And who wouldn't want a shepherd like that, as we stand here?